these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day here on RBN Network in the morning in beautiful Phoenix, Arizona, from the studios of Freedoms, with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Now, today we're going to, you know, take you into another world. We have a young woman, Tracy Harmon, has gone to Iraq, and we'll get into that story, but I want to do a quick introduction here in the short time we have in a couple of minutes for this segment. There has been a very, it's amazing to me how we have been at war. Thousands of people dying. Thousands of people going hungry. Just in the past short period of time. I mean, we're talking probably how many hundreds of thousands of people have died. How many millions of people have been displaced from their homes. Who's getting the blame for this? You want to know why, you know, they hate us for our freedom? and you have an opportunity to go back to Iraq, a young Army girl that out of the Army, she goes back on a mission, and she visits with the people. And after she leaves them, they get rocket attacked and killed. Having to go through minefields with a man on a prosthetic leg that lost his leg from a mine. Lost sons from mines, leading them in to talk to people that want just to get their story out. They want nothing more than to be heard, for the world to know what pain they're going through and who's causing it. And the people causing it don't want you to know. Tracy Harmon went to Iraq here and just got back. And she got some pictures from us you've been seeing on Freedom's Phoenix, taking little banners and stuff that we sent out with her just so we could, so you pay attention. So that you'd know that we're looking. You know, we're putting eyes out on the ground where, you know, instead of being drones, like now we talked about yesterday, United Kingdom has robot fighter craft now. You know, these are not just drones with a Hellfire missile on it. These are full-size planes that just don't have a person in it. Some guy in Langley with a joystick at 20 years old that, still got clear seal on his face. Bombing and killing people from afar. And what are they, you know, I remember a speech a gentleman said one time. He goes, you know, it's like World War II, the pilots, all they saw was little puffs of smoke. Just little puffs of smoke. You don't see, and now, it's fire and forget. You don't even see the puff of smoke. Heck, you're on your second, you're on your third, fourth target. Didn't even see the first one going. And then when you get, I think I'll go have a coffee break. And you walk down the hall and, you know, take over for me where it's on autopilot, coming back, go back and sit down. I mean, this is the kinds of wars that we're fighting now. Well, Tracy Harmon went and went face to face with the people. She's here to tell their stories. And when we come back after the break, introduce you to Tracy Harmon, a brave young woman in her mid-20s that went to Iraq, went to Kurdistan, went through Turkey, just so she could spend time with these people, get the information, and be able to tell their story. For the first time on Freedom's Phoenix, after her return trip from Iraq, will be Tracy Harmon sharing what she learned with you. You guys stay right there and call your friends, tell them, tune in! Because you're going to want to hear this one. We'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and on the line we have Tracy Harmon. I got you there, Tracy.
Hi, how's it going?
I am so relieved that you're back and safe. And
thank you.
You know, I was really, you know, you have a beautiful young woman going to the Middle East and not in your perma burqa or whatever, you're at risk. So,
I dyed my hair all dark for a reason.
Yeah, I noticed that. You know, you darkened your hair as kind of a reddish, dark brunette thing, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so I guess that was part of your camo.
Of course. You don't want Blondie walking around Iraq.
Well, tell me about, you know, let's talk about the whole thing, because I'm not even sure I know the whole story. You know, I just knew you're going fine. Here's some signs, man. Go make it, you know, worth it. Go. So go ahead and start from the beginning and tell us about when you were in the Army, you're out of the Army. You started working with Iraq Veterans Against the War. You've been a supporter of Adam Kokesh's campaign. You're doing what? Give me the whole spiel. And
from the beginning. Well, I joined the Army when I was 18. You know, I didn't have anything better to do, I guess. So I was up for the challenge. I joined, you know, I honestly wanted to see if I had what it took as a female to get through combat training. And I had a G.I. Jane complex. So I really, you know, the college money was definitely a perk, but I didn't need it. I would have been fine without it. So it was more just for, you know, just to really challenge myself. And there was a bit of patriotism there, but I had actually done some traveling before even joining the military, so I kind of got to experience culture, and you know, it was a total culture shock being in the training when I remember the drill sergeants would scream, we're training you to kill these towelheads, these goddamn towelheads, and they would refer to them as the enemy, and I remember thinking, well, wait a minute, how is that an enemy right now? You know, that's a person, too. So I kind of had those feelings early on, but just ignored it. I wanted to get through the training, and, you know, I went to Johnson Bible College in Knoxville, Tennessee, got my degree in Bible and theology, so it was really interesting. I was stationed, my duty station was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and that was where my unit was and where I was getting my degree, so I was literally studying the art of God and war. And
wow.
You know, you drive by churches and you see the American flag with the Christian flag, and that kind of starts to bother you at some point. When, you know, for me, I was a theology student and reading about Jesus teaching the love, the message of love and peace, and you know, I just thought, well, this seems to conflict. You know, I'm training for war, and yet at the same time, I had done so much traveling through internships. I'd actually done an internship in Cairo, Egypt. I was there for 3 months and lived with a Muslim family and got to hear about the war for the first time from their perspective. So all this was going on, you know, simultaneously. So I got to experience Muslim culture and, you know, that, wow, these people really just live at peace and they're, you know, no different from Christians that say they want to live in peace. And I just got to a point where during training that was, you know, I actually wanted to go to Iraq. I was graduating college. It was in my last semester. And again, it was, you know, being single, not having anything else. I just really wanted to go. I wanted to go as a humanitarian. They have civil affairs in the military. And I also qualified for the Arabic language school. So I was about ready to go to that training when, I mean, it was a lot of events that had kind of happened and that had been building up, but during training when I would rifle qualifications, I would, you know, I've never been too good of a shot, too good of a marksman, but I remember my arms would just start to shake and I couldn't get that steady trigger squeeze, and I would see the targets, they started to look like the people that I had lived with in the Middle East, the people that I had met, and that's when I just kind of, I had an epiphany that, you know, I can't be true to my faith and my beliefs and be an agent of war, especially the war in Iraq, something I have never agreed with. So I filed for conscientious objector status in the summer of 2007. And I can tell you a little bit about the CO process. It's kind of it's a very difficult process, and the military makes it difficult for a reason, because they don't want to lose bodies. That, you know, the military invests obviously a large amount of money to train soldiers, and they don't want people to question the system. So I remember when I was applying, I couldn't even find the regulation online. I couldn't download it for some reason. So that's actually how I started getting involved with Iraq Veterans Against the War and the Center for Conscientious Objection, the CCCO, and they kind of helped me through that process. So while I was in the military and kind of getting out, which the whole process took a year and a half. I started becoming more involved with Iraq Veterans Against the War as a GI resistor. And the process is kind of set up like a court case. They're basically trying to prove your sincerity of beliefs, you know, saying, like, basically, I don't want to just get out of a deployment. I really feel that I cannot be responsible for taking life in the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. I am a conscience objector.
Well, your religious training probably made that argument a little bit easier, I would imagine.
Of course it did. And, you know, you don't have to be a CO. You don't have to object on any kind of religious grounds. And I think that is one. I mean, a lot of people that try to get honorably discharged as a CO, they don't get it. I mean, I had a friend that was actually discharged when he
Tracy, did we lose you? Tracy?
So it really catches up a lot of people. It stops up a lot of people from getting that honorable discharge and recognition as a CO. But, yeah, it definitely helped because I did it on religious grounds. And so started getting involved with IVAW. And, you know, it wasn't, like I said, I wanted to go to Iraq. But I really felt that it wouldn't been, there's no justifiable reason to go over there, and there's no justifiable reason for the victims of war that are always innocent, you know, women and children that are their lives are taken. There's no way that I could be true to truly helping somebody in a humanitarian situation, even though I was looking at that with the military and going in uniform. And that's why I went to Iraq. And I just got back. That was the big reason for the trip, and I hope to do more over there is because I still have that desire to help.
Well, who did you have to convince? I mean, when you say, you know, I decided I'm just not into this killing people thing for stupid reasons, and they go, oh, okay, well, as long as you filled out the right form, and it always comes down to an individual. There's always someone that you have to convince.
That would have been my commander, our unit command sergeant major. He was a Baptist, and I used to, you know, what's funny is I used to, I wasn't a chaplain's assistant, but I just took on that role in my unit, and I used to coordinate the chapel services for everyone in my unit, and so I would get people from college, preaching majors, and they would come in and do a sermon, and so I had kind of a lot of people in my unit that would come up to me and ask me questions all the time about God and what does the God say about the Bible and war, and I kind of had that role within my unit because we didn't have a chaplain. And my commander, who I had, you know, was really close to because he was a Baptist and we really connected on our faith. And he actually said that he was extremely, extremely offended and disappointed in my decision. Because for me to say, you know, I tried to convince him, like, this is something that I feel that I have to do in my faith. It's morally right for me, but what's right for me may not be right for you. You have to come to that conclusion yourself. But by me objecting, by me deciding I don't want to do this, I'm not saying that what you're doing is wrong. And in that process, I've never criticized the troops or the soldiers that are over there fighting, doing what they're doing. I respect and support them, in fact. But there's a way. It's hard to find that way of supporting the warrior and not the war. But yeah, he was definitely, so you submit a packet and it's basically a series of essay questions. And, it's a bunch of paperwork and has to go through the chain of command. But, he, you know, would ask me tough questions, or he basically was trying to say that, it's God's will. I believe it's God's will that we're in Iraq. And I believe that, you know, so those people that are dying over there, it's because they're not Christians. They're not Christians, and maybe this will be a good way for them to come to know the Lord. That was his stance.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's what happens when you combine. I don't. That's one result of combining patriotism and religion.
It's a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool. When we come back after this break, I want to start focusing on you got out, but then you got back into something. I mean, you're starting to see that there is a way for you to express yourself in your opposition to the war, and there's a lot of ways to do that. And when we come back, we're going to find out what Tracy Harmon did to try and make sure that she expressed the love that we all should have for our fellow men. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Iraq Veterans Against the War, Tracy Harmon.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Yeah, let's just take a break. Let's just take, you know, whoa, and see what's up. Well, Tracy Harmon went and saw what's up, okay? And I tell you what's up. And when, you know, America going down, we keep this stuff up, I'm telling you. And our moral high ground comes from what, Tracy? Where does that come from? Do we have any?
We're building an empire.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. That's all we got. Well, this
700 bases in how many countries? 135 countries.
We're set to be toppled. I mean, and with good reason. I mean, you know, they'll come. I'm sure somebody's making a lot of money on that. I'm sure somebody benefits. I'm sure the guys at the top pulling the strings and flipping the switches and pulling the levers are coming out okay. But you know, the people there, the people here, everybody else is. You know, we need a there's a Nuremberg trial in our head. And I don't need some, you know, trilateral, you know, what do they call it, some kind of judge panel up there saying that they're going to decide the fate of that. You know, I can just give me enough information, I'll decide in my head. And then I just go, okay, bad guys, do I really have to do anything other than just withdraw my support of this? And that's where you became dangerous. You have an attractive young woman that was devoted, that was trained, that was schooled in exactly what they wanted in, you know, fear of the Lord, and he's telling you to go kill people. And there, and you're going, ah, you know, I'm no. So this is a powerful tool. So now you come, you're out of the Army, you get discharged under what? You get conscientious, is that honorable discharge?
Honorable, it is. And I actually had to fight through, because at first they were trying to give me a general discharge, which would have taken away all of my benefits, every last one of them. So, I had to fight for honorable, which is why it took a year and a half to get that recognition.
And then what?
And then... God, I don't know. It's just been, I started working in HIV prevention after getting out, but this trip to Iraq has been something that ever since getting out has been on my heart. You know, it's for me, it's fulfilling my obligation.
Okay, wait. We've got plenty of time when we get to that, you know, we'll get into it. But I want to build up, I mean, you were involved in Iraq Veterans Against the War. How did that happen?
Made some contacts. I was actually at a conference talking about, I don't remember what, met a person that had basically applied for the same, that I just told you about, and applied for the same CO status and was discharged medically. He told me about IVAW, and, I started getting involved with that group. Was living out in Hawaii. We worked, we had a chapter of about, Hawaii is a place has the highest population of active duty soldiers in the smallest amount of space. So we were really trying to build up the chapter. We had a chapter of three, and then we watched it grow to about 10 people, but not too much, but especially in a year, that was pretty big. So started getting involved with IVAW and learning about the anti-war movement, and through that, libertarianism. I never realized I was a libertarian. I'm a converted Democrat.
Well, you know, the one thing that's of interest to me is that, anybody that just seeks truth eventually becomes libertarian. This is how it works.
Right.
But the one thing that I'm interested in is that as you start to become more active, as you're starting to communicate with people. As you're starting to have more and more start to get together, you're 10 turns 20, it's 200, you're at large events, you're doing Winter Soldier, you have all the, you start to meet other soldiers and it comes together. And then you start to see what's happened since Obama's election. And I have to ask you, where did the anti-war movement go?
Well, they were in love with Obama.
Well, he's expanding the war.
I know, but we even our, well, I don't know if I should say this on the air, but I'm going to. Even our executive director was, she was at his inauguration fully supporting Obama. And that's what, you know, that's we lost a lot of money in IBEW during that whole time period because we saw him as the anti-war president and totally blindsided by that. I mean, we obviously, a few of us saw it coming, but a lot of people within IBEW and the anti-war movement were totally blindsided by his suave speeches and his, I don't know, his, yeah.
Lies. Okay, well, when we come back, you know, this is why we're building up to this, because in the next segment, we got a full 18-minute segment. So we can start right from the beginning. Okay, this opportunity came up. We're going to Iraq. Well, tell me in just a minute here, real quick, what was the opportunity that you had that come to you that you were able to go with some group to Iraq? Where did they come from?
Well, it was actually, I've traveled a lot. Like I said, I did an internship in Egypt, and then I also was in Pakistan 2 years after 9/11. So I've made a lot of contacts over the years, international contacts, and found out about this NGO, which I would love to be able to talk about the NGO I traveled with, but for security's sake, because they, I mean, well, we can get into that in the next segment.
Well, define NGO. I hear that a lot. A lot of people don't know what that means.
I mean, this particular one does human rights documentation.
No,
it's a non-government organization.
Non-government organization that somehow gets clearance in some special way of a secret handshake or somebody they know and send the right form somewhere, and you get to get special travel privileges to go do this kind of stuff. So when we come back, Tracy Harmon's going to tell us about her trip to Iraq and what she learned. We'll be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love.
Bring some lovin' here today. Well, we got some lovin' coming to us from Tracy Harmon. Tracy Harmon went to Iraq to share love. Now, Tracy, go ahead and tell us, you went with a non-government organization, which is to remain nameless for fear of death and damnation. So what we're going to go ahead and do is just, you hooked up with these guys, you made your reservations, you had a date that you left. I remember it was April 15th, tax day, and you you left, and tell us about your trip.
Okay. Well, I apologize for not being able to talk more about the specific NGO. It's just that even while we were leaving, there was an email that was sent to the team in Iraq. It was basically a death threat. That's why I thought I was going to have some difficulty getting out of Turkey, because someone apparently had seen us taking pictures of Turkish military bases, and we don't know who the email came from, but I mean, they get things like that all the time. So this team basically started out in Iraq in 2002, and they were basically documenting human rights violations against detainees. They were the first ones to kind of see the situation with Abu Ghraib and point that out, but because of obviously how, you know, the situation escalating, and they had some things that happened to team members, four were abducted from this NGO in 2004. And because of that situation, they basically had to leave Baghdad and moved up to the north where it was safer in Sulaymaniyah, and started working among the Kurds, documenting human rights violations against the Kurdish population in northern Iraq. So that was a big part of the trip, was getting to kind of experience what it would be like to a day in the life of an NGO worker, especially in a war zone. So, you know, when I hear that a bombing happens an hour from where we are, you know, it freaks me out, gives me the shivers, and, you know, that's nothing new to them. That's daily life. And especially the people that they work with, you know, this is something that, I mean, they've lived a lifelong PTSD. So we did two separate trips. We went up to...
PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever.
Stress disorder.
Yeah, don't do all this Army initial crap, okay? So make sure you tell everybody what you're saying.
PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Right. So we did two trips. We went up to, the first was to go up to the Turkey-Iraq border to document IDPs in the villages along that area. And it was interesting. We met with, so I guess the process, so they have been documenting these human rights violations, and it ranges from destruction of property to physical harm, and as well as there's death. And they document this. They made a report. So a big part of it is updating this report, as well as putting pressure on the right groups, the UN, HRC, other officials in Iraq, even though they don't really honestly give a shit.
Oh, Getsy, naughty words on the radio.
Sorry. anyways, so, you know, we met with, so the process is basically meeting with the Mukhtar. He is elected by the people of the village to represent the people. We met with the Mukhtar, too. They had a bombing a week earlier, and basically they lost apple. Their apple orchards were destroyed, and the village is remaining in poverty because nobody wants to work there. No one wants to harvest the field. So we were just kind of getting more information on that situation. This is up by the Turkey-Iraq border. Met with the Mukhtar, heard his explanation of the situation. Then we met with the mayor of this area. Now the mayor is elected by, he's appointed by the KRG, basically by the government. So
KRG, what's KRG?
Kurdish Regional Governance. I think that's it. Kurdish Regional Governance. I have to look that one up. It's basically, it's northern Iraq. It's Kurdistan, but it's not known as Kurdistan. It's northern Iraq, the KRG. So the mayor is appointed by the KRG, and his explanation as to, you know, we ask him, so why, you've seen this report, obviously, you know, we're showing you a report of people that have been killed from this bombing, and it's happening from Turkey, and obviously the U.S. involvement in it, like we're involved in every single goddamn thing, there he used another word, a dirty word, is that we're obviously supplying intel reports to Turkey on the reason for the bombing is they're looking for the PKK. We refer to them as a terrorist group. Turkey refers to them as a terrorist group. They are a political party in Kurdistan, and they are basically fighting for an independent Kurdistan. But they're labeled terrorists for whatever reason. Libertarians are labeled terrorists. So that's their excuse. So why they're bombing is, you know, well, we have detected PKK activity in this area. But what really happens is a Kurdish village. The Kurdish villages are bombed. Again, innocent civilians are the cost of this violence and aggression. So we give this report to the mayor, and, you know, he's basically like, oh, well, you know, most of these villages now are abandoned, and, you know, people don't want to return to their villages because they're just lazy, and they, you know, they enjoy the comforts of city life. And we're thinking, are you kidding me? You're calling these people lazy. They don't want to go back to their villages because they're being bombed. So then we meet with the family to hear their story, a family in this village. And, you know, it's basically the UNHRC has built all of these camps. And you see them, you know, up along the border. It's crazy. You see these whole, like tents and nice homes that they've built. But they're abandoned. Nobody wants to live in them because it's a bomb site. So it's kind of, again, a waste of resources and money. And then the next trip we did was to the Iran-Iraq border, and that was quite interesting. I when we met with the mayor, I tried to ask him about the sanctions, and I try to ask questions, and they won't answer them if they don't want to, and especially that's kind of where you get into cultural things, you know, me asking as a woman, and I even covered up for the most part. I wore the hijab, the head covering, but sometimes they just didn't answer my questions, and I was like, okay. So then we go up to this village, which getting to this village, and I mean, I could see, it was beautiful. I could see the mountains of Iran from right at the border. I mean, this is the same spot where the three hikers were picked up. And this is where we get into the truck. It was a bus we were in, would only go so far. So we had to walk the rest of the distance to get to this village. And I passed by, I counted 34 landmine signs. And this is where, you know, the military background comes in, and I'm thinking, oh, shit. Like, if I see a sign, and just because it's another area where there's not a sign, doesn't mean that there's not going to be a landmine. Maybe someone hasn't spotted it, or because of the years, it's been covered up. And everyone else is kind of naive to that. You know, I'm traveling with an international team, and I'm the only former military person on there, so I'm, like, gearing into military mode. All right, 3 to 5 meters, 3 to 5 meters, we've got to space out. And our the Mukhtar, the leader of the village that was leading us up to his village, he actually had a prosthetic leg. So I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm following a man with a prosthetic leg through basically a landmine field. How crazy am I? I mean, I know I'm crazy, but this is pretty nuts. But again, this is something that NGO workers do every
Well, you know, the
day.
One thing that you said, I remember in one of your reports, you were saying the gentleman that had the prosthetic leg that was leading you through these landmines lost a son or something to landmines.
Oh, yeah. His son was killed by a landmine because he's a farmer. He has apple orchards, and his son was I think, 10 or 11 and was just playing out in the field and was killed.
Yeah.
And he recently lost his leg to a landmine.
Well, you know, I'm amazed that we have these kinds of things happen, and you don't understand why someone would have animosity towards the U.S. or want to strap on, you know, a bomb and go into a village square and, you know, push the button. I mean, this, you know, they're crazy. Really, seriously, you do this to us here, I guarantee you'll have this kind of stuff happen.
Blowback. There's a lot of blowback coming. So, but this bombing, I mean, it's obviously, you know, there again, it's the result of our foreign policy. There's a Turkish military base in Iran for whatever reason. And that's where, so they're not, the villages along the Iran-Iraq border, they're getting bombing from Turkey and Iran, and it's a political situation that I'm trying to understand. But what people tell me is they're basically just trying to take out the PKK. But
as I understand it, what's going on after World War One, you had the British and the French just kind of drew lines in the sand, and they said this is this, and this sheik will be in charge of that, and we'll get somebody over here to sign the contract so the oil becomes ours, and you know that kind of thing. Well, when they did these lines, you know, they're British and French. They don't even speak the language. They don't even know what the heck's what. They didn't know that you were carving up a place that has its own culture, language, everything called Kurdistan. Kurdistan is part now is in Iraq. Yeah. It's in Turkey. It's all in that area. So they're trying to, of course, you have the Kurds want to have their own place, which would include land that's in Turkey. Well, Turkey goes, heck no. You know, because there's oil and stuff there. So it's all about, you know, we'd be a lot better off if all the Kurds were just dead. And then we can carve it up and it'll be our land, you know.
That is the big reason that there's why there's so much animosity, because there's such a large Kurdish population in Turkey and Syria. And for Kurdistan to have their independence and to, you know, be officially recognized, that they're fearing that, you know, their own Kurdish population would rise up and want to get that independence as well. So they're trying to oppress this this population, and the result is obviously genocide. You know, and then, I mean, we met with a lot of victims of the genocide of the Anfal campaign during Saddam's regime.
The gas campaign,
aerial bombing. Yes. So here's another story for you. Our driver, and I think one of the reasons why we were so protected and we were safe is, it's really, so you have the translator and the driver, and our driver, this is a new driver that we were working with, and our translator had suggested him, but the team was kind of nervous, because that's kind of how these hostage situations happen, is you have a driver that you don't know very well that can set something up. But he's a Kurdish driver, and he was new, and didn't speak any English at all. He didn't really understand at first what we were doing, but he kind of started going to some of the meetings with us and, you know, hearing the translation and hearing everything. And he thought, oh, wow, these people are working for the rights of the Kurds, of my people. So we just saw this progression of, you know, when we'd go through all these checkpoints, he would get out of the van and he would, you know, start to say, oh, no, these people are great. These people are doing this for us and they're blah, blah, blah. He became our our defense, basically, because he believed so much in what we were doing. And he was at, we later found out, he didn't charge us for the trip when we went to Halabja. If you guys are familiar with Halabja, it's a village that is where a massive genocide occurred during the ISIL campaign in 1988, where Chemical Ali, Saddam's cousin, basically got his name, his nickname. But how many people? About 5,000 were killed. By they had 2 days of gas attacks, and there's still now about over 7,000 that are still receiving. We're still seeing the effects of those gas attacks, with children that are being born with birth defects and all that stuff. So he was a survivor. Our driver was a survivor of Halabja. And if I can just tell this, how he survived that attack, they started out with the bombing. And he was basically in the basement with his family. And this bomb landed right in the middle, but it didn't explode. So then they got out immediately, fled the mountains, and they had the women with them, and they basically said, well, no, we need to go back for more. We need to go back for other people. And so they kept the women, and then the men went back to the village, and when they went back, someone said, no, don't come back. They're all dead. They're all dead. Because it started out with the bombing, and then the gas attacks came, and he described it as, you know, some survived just by merely covering up, but it's odorless. It's an odorless smell. Or someone also that we talked to said it smelled like strawberries or something. It smelled good when they're breathing this in, and it within 30 minutes, you know, and it's just.
And then there were some mass graves I saw that you were at too.
Oh yeah, the massive grave site where there's 10,000 bodies buried under 500 marked tombs. He buried people alive. I mean, people were telling us stories about how they remember. They would pack them up in truckloads and just would dig a grave, and they would literally bury them alive. A lot of these people, and it's really frustrating, honestly. You know, to think like that. Of course, Saddam is an evil dictator. You know, and it doesn't matter. I don't give a damn that we came in there and removed him. I don't give a damn. It does not justify what we're doing in Iraq, because we're the ones that put him into power in the first place. Again, a result of our intervention foreign policy, a result of us expanding our empire.
So what do you think the solution is? I got in this segment a couple of minutes. What is the message that you want to bring back to your generation or everybody?
With Kurdistan right now, it's really tricky, because if they get their independence, and I, of course, am in full support of any population of having their own recognition, independence. But if they get that, then they're basically going to be left alone to the wolves. They're not going to get the backing of the Iraqi central government. Turkey and Iran are already bombing the hell out of them. So really the solution is just making people aware of the situation, of documenting these human rights violations that are happening among the Kurds, and putting pressure on the right people to do something about it.
What? I mean, you know, this is, we need to get involved more. We create all these problems over a generation.
No, we don't. We need to get the hell out. We need to keep out. But there's still work to be done among, I guess, to draw a conclusion to it, if somebody really wants to help, if somebody really wants to do something good over there, join a peace delegation, join an NGO, and you know, I only did it for 2 weeks, but there's a team of 3 people there. You know, they need more people to go over. I'm calling on soldiers to resist their deployments, if I can be so bold to say that. Don't go with the military, go with an NGO, go on a peace mission. And if you really want to serve your country, then do something for the good of humanity.
Do something good. We're going to do some more good when we come back here on Declare Your Independence. That's right. Spreading the love. Where's the love? Right here.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and Tracy Harmon, one of my favorite people from Iraq. She just got back, and she's sharing with us details about her trip. And after all of this, we got a lot of good photos. Thank you. And, you know, what was probably one of your favorites there? What the people that would see it, certainly people that could understand what the signs said. What was the one that they were attracted to the most?
The photo. I would probably say the one from the bomb shelter, because that was the village that was so challenging to get up there. And I'm even pretty physically fit, and it was just straining. And that's also when we came home. I mean, we got back to Suleimania, we found out that they had just received an attack 2 hours after we had left, and two people were killed. And to see in this village, I mean, that's just one little bomb shelter, but they had multiple. I mean, you would see homes, and then it's like the community center. You know, you've got a row of bomb shelters, and that's just daily life for them. So but the picture I have on my profile pic of just holding up the Where's the Love sign, you know, what, this is not right. This is not right that a village has to have bomb shelters as a part of their structure. I mean, it's not right.
Are there programs where they're trying to give these guys an incentive to leave? If you move across this line, we'll give you 40 acres and a mule. I mean, are they trying to coerce them out?
I'm sure there are, but not that I'm aware of or anything. But it's also, it's their land. I mean, it's good soil. Even like this man that has a prosthetic leg and that lost his son, that's the best. He still farms there. He goes, he knows where. They even pointed out a landmine. He knows where they are, but I mean, that's their
who
land.
Put the so landmines there and why?
They were, I mean, they're from everybody, from Iran, Saddam, from Turkey. It's just so all throughout the 80s and the 90s, it's just kind of been a collection.
Do they have any kind of a devices to go out and find them, or?
They actually had a group that I can't remember the name of, the NGO that goes in there and they remove these landmines, but they don't. I mean, and sometimes they'll just put little signs up like we saw, but they don't pick them up all the time. And sometimes they get bare. I mean, like when we were, you know, the man that lost the leg, he had this NGO that went through the entire village, and supposedly, and they're doing their best, but you can't catch everything. So.
Wow.
And people want to hike up there. People want to. It's so sad because it's the most beautiful piece of land I've ever seen with the mountains. But it's.
Want it. And if you don't have big guns yourself, you're not North Korea with your own nuke. They come after you.
Yeah. Well, I'm so sorry for my offensive language. I apologize.
No,
Army. I got a little carried away.
Yeah, it's because you're in the Army.
Well, I was a grunt. So
one thing I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about in the last couple of minutes here is what's your plans for your time now? What are you going to do? I mean, after you come off a high like this, it's hard to beat it.
I'm working on Adam Kokesh's campaign. He's running for 3rd congressional district in San Fe, New Mexico. And actually, today we're having a money bomb. So if you want to donate to
KokeshForCongress.com.
KokeshForCongress, you can donate.
KOKESH. KOKESH for Congress.com.
For Congress.
How is that? When's his primary? How's that going?
It's going well. It's June 1st. So there's a lot of work to be done. And we're actually bringing in volunteers for a program called Summer in Santa Fe. So if you want to come out here and work, again, go to the website, Kokesh for Congress, and you can find more information on that.
KOKESH. KokeshForCongress.com.
Kokesh for Congress.
Well, I'm sure he's glad to have you back safe and sound, as we all are. Tracy, mm-hmm. Thank you for coming on and spending time with us, because this is a perspective we wouldn't have got.